Can you hear me okay?
Yeah.
Great. Thanks, Odette. I know one of the questions that a lot of you have when you build a trail or purchase a property or do something cool with your agency or your NGO is, why did anybody cover it, right? And you look at media companies and it's like looking at the Social Security Administration or something, right? It's this giant faceless monolith and you don't know anybody behind the wall and you don't know how to communicate with them. And I'm here to say that there are some tips and tactics that you can use to sort of break through that wall and get your stuff covered. We do have a big challenge, though, which is that the internet has completely broken the business model of newspapers, which used to be really the main way that open space and parks got covered. I've been doing this for about 30 years now, and I would say that, you know, 15 to 20 years ago, there were probably 30 or 40 journalists in California who gave 40 million people who live here most of what they know about parks and open space, from Yosemite to state parks to regional aid organizations like yours. There were probably 10 to 15 now. I'm talking about mainstream news organizations. And the reason is because, simply put, newspapers used to make money three ways. They made money by selling help wanted ads, right, when they charge you $100 for your garage sale to get three lines in the paper. They made money by putting what we call display ads, like a movie or a department store. And they made money by circulation, selling copies and subscriptions. The internet has broken all of that. Basically, the overall revenues, and I just looked this up this morning, for every newspaper in America from 2006 to 2016, total ad revenues have fallen 64%, from $50 billion to $18 billion. Imagine if your organization lost 64% of its budget, the capacity loss like that, what you'd be able to do in over 10 years. And that's what's happened. Those ads have gone to Facebook, they've gone to Google, the help wanted ads have gone to Craigslist and eBay. People can get a lot of information for free online. And so newspapers are trying to reinvent the way that they fund the coverage that they've done for 200 years. That means there's fewer environmental journalists. And with fewer environmental journalists, there are different tactics to reach them. I'll talk about that in just a sec. But there is some good news. There are some newer models that are developing.
And I pick up there. Am I on? The internet has raised havoc with the model of journalism, but it has also been the birthplace of new forms of environmental journalism. And it's more disaggregated, it's harder to get a big audience with these sites, but I'm gonna name some, and some of you will have heard of a lot of them. There's one that's been going for more than a decade up out of Seattle called grist.org. It's funded by a philanthropist, I believe, from Switzerland, and they do good environmental journalism. They've tried different tones with it, but they cover the waterfront of a lot of subjects, including open space subjects. There are others that are newer than that, in one case, this Walry won a Pulitzer Prize. That's Inside Climate News, which won the prize for revealing what Exxon knew and when they knew it about climate change. And even newer than that, there are places where some of the environmental reporters that Paul talked about who are no longer there in mainstream newspapers, some of them have gone to sites like Water Deeply or Circle of Blue. Climate change and water are two places on the web where you can find at least two or three and sometimes many more sites that do environmental journalism. There are also sites that you can find on the web that are radio-based, like KQED, but they have a web presence with environmental reporting, too, that I know that do good reporting is our Colorado Public Radio and Oregon Public Radio. And then, in the world of podcasts, there is a brand new, and I'm talking 3 months old, environmentally-themed podcast called Podship Earth, which is hosted by Jared Blumenfeld, who used to be the Region 9 director of the EPA in San Francisco for under the Obama presidency. And finally, there are other sites that are based at universities, which gets to me. There is something at Yale called Environment 360, which is a great magazine, covers all sorts of subjects, including open space. And there they are, there's our site and the West at Stanford University. And at the University of New Mexico, there's Inkstain, which is also run by a former environmental journalist, a guy named John Fleck. He does an awful lot about the Colorado River. Again, water is one of the main subjects. But one thing I think about in terms of what's happening to environmental journalism as it goes online, what Paul and I do with words, we can be proud of. We've done a lot with our words. But there's a whole new form of journalism, and you've seen it, and of communication, and you've seen it throughout this conference on the screen behind me. Environmental graphics, there's more and more and more data. And as more people are looking at things on small screens, you're going to see a lot more information conveyed graphically, because that really gets the point home fast. And, when we did one, after this conference, I'm hoping you'll be able to see a graphic we did on all the conservation easements in America, mapped against the federal public lands. And you can zoom in on that map and see who owns each easement. This is one of the futures of environmental journalism.
Paul and Felicity, I think you were scratching the surface there, both on what the realities are on the ground and what the new trend points are, the new pathways. So there are absolutely changes in the traditional journalism model, and you talked about the budget cuts. Now we have all of the social media portals that bring all this data and perspective rapid fire. How do the organizations right now in this room make sure that their issues and stories get that coverage in a really dynamic and ongoing way?
Yes, it's a good question. With so many fewer reporters out there, it's harder for everything to get covered, right? I mean, both the San Francisco Chronicle and the San Jose Mercury News have, and this is a rough estimate, have reduced their staff by 50 to 75% since the year 2000. Again, think about what would happen to your organization if you cut half to three quarters of your employees, just in terms of what you're able to do. And it still has to come out every morning. The Mercury News is the oldest business in Santa Clara County. It's the oldest newspaper in California. It was founded in 1851. It's come out every morning since 1851. And so whether we have, 500 people or 50, it still has to come out. And I think there are some tactics that you can use for those of us who are waiting for a new economic model to begin expansion again. There's a lot that we're working on, like paywalls and things like that, that have some promise. But I'll just list a couple of quick tips that I would recommend to folks. You can't just send press releases over the transom anymore into, the San Francisco Chronicle or the New York Times or KQED. Right? There are 400 people who work at KQED. Send it a press release, nobody knows whether it's going to get to the right person. So what you need to do is a little bit of research to see who it is in your area that covers parks and open space and the environment science specifically. Treat that person like you would any other networking relationship in your job. Have lunch with them. I regularly have off-the-record lunches with people who run organizations like yours and run water agencies and other agencies. And I just sit down and say, hey, tell me the five most important things you're working on this year. And they will. They'll say, well, this isn't ready to come out yet, but I wanted you to know about this. And I'll say, okay, well, when is that coming out? When can I register about that? And we agree on timing. We talk about issues that they're facing. They ask questions like, why did you not cover this? Or why did you screw that up? And we exchange each other's cell phone numbers. And that's what journalists need. We need relationships with the people who run these organizations. We don't need PR firms. Every day I come into the office and I get boxes full of junk, like t-shirts, and I literally open these boxes and give it to my kids. I don't read the stuff. And these agencies spend thousands of dollars. All I need is lunch with your CEO, right? And I make long story lists. So the first thing is make a relationship. Second is you have to hold the journalist's hand a little more than you did in the past. So if you're buying a piece of property and it's got beautiful oak trees on it, go out and take some pictures of the oak trees, hire a photographer, shoot 30 seconds of beautiful high-def footage that someone could use on television or embed on a website. Put them up on a password-protected site, and then when your press release goes out, you're telling all the journalists, here's pictures of our property. Do that with maps. Give the journalist the story as much as you can in a box with a bow on top of it, because we don't have as many photographers and graphics people as we used to. So That's the last thing. And then finally, be very active with your own email newsletters and your own social media. We all follow that. But, you know, you all have printing presses now. You all have TV stations with YouTube. So use those. Happy to talk more about those. But get to know us. Tell us stuff early. Don't just throw a press release over the transom into a big pile.
This is just to emphasize the truth of what Paul just said. If you know what a journalist is interested in, either because you contacted them ahead of time or because you've read their stuff, that is a huge part of what will help make the connection. It may not get in a story you particularly want at that moment, but it will build the bridge of trust that will be useful when there's something else either the journalist wants to find out from you or you want to come back with a different story. One of the things that the internet has done is created a lot more sites, but it's made it much more incumbent on you, as Paul said, to figure out where a good idea might go, who might be interested, and you have to find those people. It means more work for you. But again, if it's work by an individual who runs the organization, who's part of the organization, who wants to make a personal connection, that's going to mean a lot more in a box full of t-shirts. Although I miss the t-shirts, I don't get them.
When we were having this conversation about this dialogue, I remember clearly both Felicity's points, but Paul, and I believe Sam Hutter is still around, but Sam being on your speed dial, and just having built that sense of relationship and trust to know that when you call, say the Redwoods, when you call Sam, you know that you're going to get a trusted voice and an expert set of data and an expert set of perspectives. The same for David Shaw or Greg Moore in the Parks Conservancy, or Sharon Wintam in the Parks Conservancy, or the Presidio Trust, or Steve over at Mid-Peninsula, that these are folks who are accessible, or maybe it's their deputy, maybe it's their communications person, but there's been a relationship that's been built. And I think much of what I shared earlier, and I'm kind of just gonna show these two clips of how important that poll was about communities of color and their voice in this space. One of the campaigns that we did at New America Media with Resource Legacy Fund and with the California Coastal Commission was a reporting fellowship on coastal access. And it was about bringing that context to communities of color and what exactly does the coast mean to them through the lens of the ethnic media that cover them. And so you have these two examples. Charlene Muhammad, an amazing veteran reporter out in Southern California, in LA Sentinel, talking about the Black surfers. And here, local, homegrown, Filipino-American multimedia producer who actually is creating a book called Beach Line and Beach Shoreline and Beach Communities, a book and a Facebook page, or Inquirer.net, a Philippine-based but also is located in the Bay Area, talking about Filipino fishermen, what Pacifica Pier means. When we talk about general market media, niche media, diverse media, there needs to be that relational and not just transactional aspect that happens. As Paul says, knowing when their press day is and not to get frustrated that you're calling them on a Wednesday and they're not responding, it's because they're laying out their paper. Or that as an organization, you're providing that spokesperson who can speak Chinese, who can speak Spanish, who knows the context of the African-American experience when it comes to open space. So really knowing those cultural contexts and sensibilities is so important. I think I have one last question before the Q&A. Perfect. And I'm going to grab my phone in a little bit because I think I need to be in touch with what's going on next. Maybe as just a last question here for Felicity and Paul, and it's very much intertwined with what we've been talking about, that some of the organizations in this room are quite small in staff and resources. They don't necessarily have the communication staff. What can they do to effectively get that coverage, really have effective messaging, and get their issue?
Anytime you write anything, whether it's a press release or a news story or almost anything, there's sort of two rules that I like to use. Every writer has different rules, but I used to teach science writing at Berkeley and UCSC, and I would always tell my students the two questions you need to ask, first of all, is what is this story about? You have to be able to explain in one sentence what is it that is the main point of what you're trying to say. It's not tell me the methodology first. It's not put the most important fact in the 10th paragraph because the board wants to see their names above it. It's tell me right at the top, what is this story about? You know, second, why does my grandmother or grandfather care? I always like to think I'm not writing for scientists, I'm not writing for people who run NGOs, I'm not writing for biologists, I'm writing for regular people sitting at home, reading their phone, reading the newspaper, or listening to KQED on the radio, and ask yourself, it's a question of relevance. Why would somebody who's not a member of your organization care? And I say probably four or five times a week to scientists and public policy people in Sacramento, why does a guy who sells tires at Sears care about this issue, right? You're not just preaching to your own choir. You need to say, this is, you know, the largest collection of oak woodlands still left in Sonoma County that hasn't been preserved, or whatever. You need to give us some reason to care. And so I think if you have those two kind of guide stars, it helps journalists and the public pay attention and want to cover it.
And I would just follow up, endorse everything he said, but one reason to care might be because whatever it is you have or you want to tell a reporter about, it is part of a larger trend that has to do with everything's being disrupted these days by technology. Maybe this, what you are selling, is part of that disruption. Maybe it has to do with you, when you mentioned AI. Getting into the end of this subject. One thing I'm looking at a lot more is the way environmental stories and health stories are overlapping. That's part of your title now. But that is, if you can find a reason to care that is broader than just that particular patch of oak woodlands, but has to do with, maybe it's not climate change, maybe it is changing the way soil absorbs carbon. There are lots of different things happening in the world that you can bring to a story about a particular action by your organization.
A good example is, if you go to a cocktail party and someone asks what you're working on and they're not another person in your field, what do you tell them, right? You tell them the thing that you think is the coolest about what you're doing. Hey, I'm just buying this redwood forest and it used to be owned by this family that had one, whatever the thing is, that's what you tell them. So that's what you need to have at the top of your press releases. That's what you need to tell the journalists you deal with. So many times the emails and the press releases we get are just clogged up with just useless verbiage that, again, are trying to please people's boards or funders. And what happens, most journalists, we get 200 to 300 emails a day. So we're probably spending 20 seconds reading your press release, max. If you don't hook us in the first paragraph or two, just like a reader, just like you, you click the page, on to the next one.
Or as Ed said, on the climate change angle, sea level rise in the Bay Area is going to be huge and only getting huger. What is it? Is there some relationship to sea level rise in terms of your particular project or something you want to catch a journalist about? I think it's startling to look at how little Bay Area communities are doing about sea level rise, given all the science in this area.
The why do we need to care is so key. And for the city, I think we are going to start our Q&A very, very soon here, but something that grabbed me from your blog headlines was native fishing rights. And how do we broaden that conversation? I think that you've really brought that to the national discourse, and like how does the entire audience of those who care about the environment and the planet need to know about this topic?
We'll see what the Supreme Court does with the Washington Culverts case.
All right, so we're now going to throw the floor right over to you guys. I think there may be some burning questions out there. We're going to open up our Q&A, have Paul and Felicity answer your questions. We have a few ground rules. We'd like to accommodate as many questions as possible. I'm going to try to be as inclusive of the geography of this space. We have runners. We have two runners with mics. I think we have about two questions at the moment. Just please state your name and your affiliation, and if you can keep your questions about 20 seconds, that would be Do we see some hands up?
Yes, the gentleman over there.
Hi, Paul.
Yeah.
It's not a Stu Weiss. I work on CLM and chase butterflies for a living. I had a question about the feedback that you get, say, when that Coyote Valley linkage article went out. That was a really big newspaper. What feedback do you get, or the newspaper get, about the value of telling that story?
Good question. We used to gauge that by things like letters to the editor and phone calls and, you know, emails and things like that. And I can say most of the stories that I write about parks and open space always get, you know, a lot of positive feedback. People, they see so much negative news in the newspaper. And I always tell folks, news isn't just plane crashing. It's not just bad things happening. News is good things happening, too. You know, there's a lot of successful trends in the environmental movement. You look at the amount of acreage that was preserved in the Bay Area in 1970 compared to now, or you look at the successes of laws like the Clean Water Act, for example. You know, there's a lot of things that we need to be reporting on that are successes, and people see those kind of stories as a breath of fresh air. We can also see now how many people click on things, and that's really useful. And what we find is when we put up things like videos, when we put up slideshows, people, they go through all the slides, they're interested. And so if you've done these kind of stories with reporters, radio, TV, print, you're probably surprised sometimes the photographer will pull you aside and say, I need you to talk for 60 seconds about why this piece of property is cool. And you think, well, I wasn't prepared for this, right? But that little video we then send out on Facebook, and we put it on Twitter, and we use it to lure people into the story. So, you know, I think these stories are popular. I cover a broad range of issues on the environment. You know, I've been writing a lot about the Delta Tunnels right now. But I always like coming back to this because it affects so many things. You know, water quality, recreation, and, you know, all the issues that I mean, wildlife. And the public, especially longtime residents of the Bay Area, feel that we've lost a lot with urban sprawl. And so I think, I've always thought that park stories are undercover. So many people go to parks and they don't know how it got there. They just assume, well, that's always been saved. It's like, no, this is a very small, dedicated group of people who have saved these places for all of you and your children and grandchildren. And it's incumbent on us to tell those stories so eventually they'll get put on a plaque somewhere. So eventually they'll get put in a book, right? So people will know who people like, you know, Edgar Wayburn and Florence LaRiviere and people like that are. Because this would be a very different place without them. Someone's got to start. We're writing the first draft of history. So you can help us do that.
Next question. Yes, the gentleman in blue.
Hi, thanks for your time. I'm a fellow writer, but I'm one of these millennials who's doing the content on the internet. And as you know, sometimes that's journalistic, sometimes it's not. I guess I'm looking for your advice, your insight, from your experience. What could we do to be less competitive with you in the sense of battling for business market space to contribute more to what we all want here today, which is more sustainable communities, environments, in a way that we still fit in. As you rightly pointed out, there's no space in the print media for a lot of us.
Welcome to the world that I just joined, or maybe you could welcome me to the world you were already in. I am half-con, and the person who, my co-editor, who's a graphic specialist, Jeff McGee, he's doing 20 other things, so he's half-time or less. So we have one person for an environmental journalism outlet. It makes absolutely no sense for us to choose stories that Paul's going to do much better with more resources, or that the New York Times is going to do with six people and tremendous graphics. What makes sense is finding a niche that is close to the news, but that is not really being covered by others. And I think in the future, the competition thing, journalism, there will always be very competitive journalism. Look at the New York Times and the Washington Post in Washington right now. And we all benefit from their competition. But for the kind of journalism that I want to do going forward, that I want this blog to continue after I'm no longer with it, I think it's collaborative. I think when you don't have a lot of resources, you don't need to say, I'm going to get this before Paul does. It just, it's a waste of time, and you end up having incremental little scoops. To do the larger stories, I think we're going to end up doing much more collaborative work. I'm already in touch. It's, you know, it's a really early stage, but in touch with a former Times colleague who's at Arizona State at the Cronkite School, and she is a former journalist who's at University of Colorado Boulder, and I'm thinking there might be a way to create a network of environmental journalists who are university-based who might team up with some of the radios, the NPR stations I talked about. That, I think, is the future. It's not competition, it's collaborative, and it's finding what the big boys aren't doing.
Yeah, and, you know, we've seen small organizations do really well in terms of beating everybody else on important stories. High Country News, the circulation of High Country News is maybe 25,000. They've been doing this for 30 years. You know, if you read something in the New York Times about Wyoming, it was in High Country News 3 months ago, right? Because they have people in Lander, Wyoming, or, you know, in Panguitch, Utah, right, wherever you are. And so I think these nonprofit online journalism models are already starting to partner with a lot of traditional media in ways that they weren't before. So you look at an organization like Cal Matters in Sacramento, or Kaiser Health News. Those are good journalists. Many of them have come out of traditional journalism companies. They write stories which they give free to the newspapers, and we publish them with their bylines on them. So I think there are other ways like that to sort of get into the conversation. And then finally, you mentioned NPR stations. You know, we've talked about how the newspaper business model is broken. The NPR business model is not. There are 900 NPR stations in America. KQED is the only one, by the way, in the United States in a large market that is the number one radio station in terms of audience. People here love NPR. There's a million listeners to KQED, you know, and out of 7 million people here regularly. And so I've always thought those stations, if they worked together better, they would be bigger than the Associated Press, right? It's 900 bureaus around the country. So I think this stuff is evolving, it's solving itself. I'm an optimist that, you know, the business models are slowly starting to work their way out, and people are willing to pay for journalism in ways that they weren't before, and that's encouraging. I think people in the last few years have really started to give a lot more money to journalism. They realize how important journalism is to democracy. And having very few people covering government agencies, covering city council meetings, is not healthy for democracy.
Thank you for the questions. And I know we could sit here and talk for another 3 more hours, but there's an exciting legislative session panel coming up next. Please look at us, Paul, the city, myself, as resources for you. Deb knows where we live, Deb knows where we are, and how we can be reached. And we've got our Twitter handles, but thank you. Let's give a big round of applause to Felicity and Paul.